The Writer Files, a member of the Podglomerate Network.
I did a lot of research since I was a kid on the cultures in Mexico, because in Mexico City, by the way, when you grow up in that city, it's crazy that you go to the downtown Mexico City. My mom was friends with a lot of archaeologists and indigenous leaders. And like you go into the Zócalo, the main plaza, and there's Aztec faces breaking from the pavement as if they're trying to escape the underworld. And you grow up seeing that. And then as a kid, very early on, they take you to Templo Mayor, which is this pyramid underneath the churches in Mexico, an excavation where you can literally go underneath the street and visit a pyramid that is kind of at the foundation of some of the oldest churches from the time of the Spaniard conquest, which they use the same stones to pull. They pulled them from the pyramids because the Spaniards, during the conquest, they were smart. They said, like, on top of every pyramid, let's build a church.
And welcome back to The Writer Files. I am your grateful host, Kelton Reed, wishing you pages, patience, and perseverance per usual. Award-winning author, visual artist, and filmmaker Leopoldo Gu spoke with me about making music videos for David Byrne, going from homeless auteur to working with James Patterson, his unique creative process, and his latest horror novel, Piñata. Leopoldo is the author of the books Ghost Radio, the award-winning Genius YA trilogy, and the recently published fable for all ages, Monarca. He's also packaged, published, and developed books with other writers under his imprint at Simon & Schuster, and he was co-president of the James Patterson Entertainment Company for many years. His latest novel is Piñata, described as a bone-chilling possession tale, perfect for fans of Hereditary and Head Full of Ghosts, based on the true horrific story of the Spanish conquistadors that used piñatas to force Aztec children to destroy their gods. Publishers Weekly wrote of the author, Gu puts a unique twist on a classic possession story by incorporating indigenous Mexican lore into the gory plot. Leopoldo is an accomplished visual artist, filmmaker, and writer from Mexico City and studied sculpture at Central St. Martin's School of Art in London. He's currently producing award-winning author Marlon James' original debut for television, Get Millie Black, for Channel 4 and HBO, and was the executive producer of the film Molly's Game, starring Jessica Chastain and Idris Elba. In this file, Leopoldo and I discussed how his early life in Mexico contributed to a life of curiosity. Working with Pedro Pascal, star of The Mandalorian and The Last of Us, why the horror genre was a great fit for his artistic sensibilities, what it was like to work with Aaron Sorkin on Molly's Game, using research and meditation to beat creative block, overcoming your fear of failure, and a lot more. Stay calm and write on. And don't forget, you can always support this show by heading to writerfiles.fm, where you can also sign up for email updates, get links to merch, and other resources for writers. And if you're a fan of The Writer Files, please click follow to automatically see new interviews in your podcatcher as soon as they're published, and drop us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you tune in to help other writers find us. All right, we are back on The Writer Files, and I am honored today to be joined by an esteemed guest. We have the award-winning author, artist, and filmmaker, of course, and many other things, but we have Leopoldo Gu is joining us today. Thank you so much for taking time to do this, and I hope I have pronounced your name properly.
Thank you. Yes, that's it's a weird spelling, and I always struggle with it.
Well, we appreciate your time and your patience. Of course, we've been suffering from a little bit of technical difficulties, but now that we're on the line, we're going to pray for the best, and hopefully we can talk about all about writing, of course, your latest, and then this really, really interesting career and life that you've had. I can't wait to talk about all the things, because you are a multi-hyphenate, and we would seem have quite a few balls in the air at any given time, but yeah, I guess talk about how you're feeling about now, kind of on the at the birth of your latest novel, and kind of what's the vibe over there.
Absolutely. Well, it's Piñata, my latest novel, and so obviously I'm nervous. I hope that people like it. And I put years and years and years on everything I do. And, you know, people think that being a hyphenate is like kind of like in design, trying to explore different channels of creativity, but it's really not. Like everything that I do has been kind of reacting to a circumstance, an opportunity, more than me chasing down something. Like I have ways to expressing myself, and sometimes they manifest in a painting, and sometimes in a book, and sometimes in a movie or a TV show. And it's been reaction to fear of poverty in the one hand. Like I came as an immigrant to the States, and you know, I married my wife now of 20 years, and I have two kids, and you know, just the fear of not being able to provide for them. I helped my parents as well financially until my mom passed away. My dad, I still help him. Like classic immigrant. So I reacted with opportunities, because what I love about this country is that, you know, they really have found people that value my ideas and my work and the things that I create and develop. And I found a system of support across many different, you know, types of storytelling. At the end of the day, I love to tell this story. When my mom passed away, she left me this gift of all my grades from like primary school and just after kindergarten, and all of them, the same message was there from the teachers, basically saying, you know, I look at your son and he's smart, but unfortunately he'll never make it, because all he cares of is writing his little stories and drawing his little doodles. But for 4 years in a row, that's what they said, and they would tried to flunk me. And I remember my mom signing those letters from school, those grades from school, with a lot of confidence. And she will just encourage me to follow my path. So more than hyphenate is I follow the opportunities that confront me, and I go and I dive deep into them.
Yeah. And it is an inspiring story. Of course, it seems to be quite an interesting path to novelism. Of course, this is not your first novel, but it is a little bit different genre for you. Is that right?
Not really. My first novel actually was Ghost Radio, which right now is getting a huge bump in the audiobook world, because when I wrote it in 2007, it was published in 2008 by William Morrow. It started as a graphic novel. I was, you know, I've always painted since I'm a kid, and I was doing this graphic novel, and I suffered a huge fire. I lost my home. I was married. My boy, my son was born. He was about 6 months old, and we were really homeless. So I started to get, you know, I was depressed, but instead of going back to the studio, because my home was also my studio. So, you know, when I lost that, it was kind of disorienting. And I was doing this graphic novel, kind of like a horror. I've been a big fan of all the genre kind of since I was a kid, and I saw The Night of the Living Dead, and I started reading Pet Sematary by Stephen King and things like that. So I started to do this graphic novel of what you lose when you come to the States and what you win. And it was kind of weird and horrific. And an editor for Morrow read it and said, look, I'll pay you X amount for a graphic novel, but I'll pay you Y amount for a book. And I said, but I've never written a book. And he said, yeah, but the writing is really good. So I just like jumped into it. And that was my first novel, and it was a horror, and the audiobook was done, you know, Morrow, I'm a huge fan, is like the home of like Neil Stevenson and Neil Gaiman and Guillermo del Toro writing a book there and all of these amazing people. So, you know, I was super, super happy with Ghost Radio, my first novel, going there. And in the audiobook, they hired a young up-and-coming actor who was kind of like a waiter slash actor at the time or something. He was like a struggling actor. But it happened now that it turned out that struggling actor is Pedro Pascal. And obviously, he's now one of the best actors working today. And he did my audiobook. So the internet kind of just discovered it. And they've been posting all sorts of things of all of his fans are putting some provocative things about the audiobook. And so it's really very funny. That was my first horror novel. And there are little things between Ghost Radio and the now my new book, Piñata. There's little connections that hopefully the readers of both will find. There's kind of like hidden message between one book and this one, because there are some echoes in the themes, They're very different books, completely different, but there is a connection that I put there, kind of like came out of my heart.
Yes, and of course, if listeners aren't familiar with Pedro Pascal's work, most recently The Last of Us for HBO, right? And then The Mandalorian and many other fantastic portrayals, but he's really had a kind of a rise in popularity. What a cool story.
It's really weird. My life has always been like that. I know it's been like, and it gets kind of crazier because one time I had a dinner with him because he did Narcos and I cast in one of my TV shows, I cast an actor that invited me to a big HBO party. And I started talking to Pedro and I said, "Hey, Pedro, I love your work. I'd love one day for us to work together." And he's the one who reminded me. He said, "But Leopoldo, we've worked together before." And I was so embarrassed. But it's just when you're a young actor, I mean, when you're a young author, they don't let you go near the recordings of the audiobooks. They don't want the author there kind of like directing. So I never met him and I didn't know. I just loved who did the voice, but I wasn't like, I've done so many things in my life that it wasn't at the top of my head who did the audiobooks of my books. Now I'm like, I learned my lesson because, if one day Pedro hears this podcast, just, I'm so sorry, man. I really love you. And it was not on purpose. They just don't let you follow, like, they don't let you near 1,000 yards from the recordings. So it's very funny.
Yeah, that's a great story. Well, before we dig in a little bit further into Piñata, this supernatural vengeance horror driven by the real horrors of colonialism in your native Mexico. Yeah, I mean, I want to dig back a little bit into your kind of meandering path to this project. But of course, you know, you come from a background, you're a visual artist. You're also a filmmaker and a TV producer, or you know, you've worked with some really big name folks, but you were also co-president of the James Patterson Entertainment Company for some time. Talk about like which came first, because obviously you've been an artist your whole life, right?
Yeah, I mean, like since I'm four, I'm painting, and I sold my first doodle when I was that age, I think, and I got a scholarship to study sculpture in St. Martin's, which is a super fancy art school in London, Central St. Martin School of Art. And I was very lucky because it was a great way to get out of Mexico and study art. And I really believed that I was going to be a practicing artist, which I am now. But as I said, I had a very strange upbringing. My mom, we didn't have a lot of money, but we had a lot of books and friends and writers and poets and painters would come home with, you know, endless dinners with my mom and my stepdad, who became he was a very, very famous journalist. But they didn't, you know, in Mexico, it was not like we had a middle class, straight middle class background, but it was amazing the kind of people that I met through them, like from, you know, famous filmmakers to writers. And it was fascinating to listen to those dinners. I would pretend to go to sleep, but then I would steal the wine and cigarettes and just listen it for hours. And also, in the books and the National Geographics that my mom had, I always felt that my destiny was going to be to get out into the world and look at it around. And you know, in Mexico, we traveled a lot there. My mom was an activist, so she exposed me to a lot of incredible things. And working, you know, she did projects with indigenous people and with all sorts of people of different backgrounds, and she was surrounded herself to amazing people from really every angle of the world, and she gave me the gift of that curiosity for the others. And her best friend was a very super well known gay hairdresser who was the center of like certain types of people in Mexico City. So I grew up like really not with no prejudice, and it was really a gift because the world, a lot of my friends didn't have the luck that I had with so much culture injected into my brains and into my blood system. And, you know, I visited artists and I remember the smell of their art studios and all of that kind of informed me. So the story it came back to when I finished art school. I had a gallery show very early in my 20s, and I started to have a pretty good relationship with my work and as a profession. I had a great studio in New York City, and then one day we did a kind of a music. Some friends of mine introduced me to David Byrne, who's the amazing singer and songwriter of Talking Heads, who, he was performing last night with his crazy song in the Oscars. And he got a little piece of my work and very encouragingly gave us some money to do a music video. And I didn't know what, really, I love music videos, but I was not into film. I was just doing weird, like little experimental videos. But my younger brother is a very passionate filmmaker, and he's always been a director. He's now, we're editing our own show for Netflix called El Elegido, The Chosen One, based on American Jesus by Mark Millar. And he was always a director, and I called him and said, hey, I think I got some money to do an art thing. And so we joined forces in many, many projects like that, that kind of became my film school, like just working for dozens or hundreds of music videos and commercials and short films that we shot all over the world. And it was very kind of like lucky time at the end of the business of the music industry. And I, and that really allowed us, because it was just him and me and a DP, and we owned the company and we tried to buy equipment. So, but we were really like efficiently making them, and we'd direct them, produce them, edit them. The whole thing was internal. We never signed with any big production company to manage our thing. It was very, very, very much our own kind of path, and that connected me to the film industry. And then the opportunity of the James Patterson opportunity was stranger than you can imagine, because I was trying to just get out of my depression from losing my house and my art studio from the fire, and I was writing Ghost Radio, and then like I was doing a lot of post-production of my music videos in this beautiful company called Curious Pictures that closed down. But they were like an amazing creative hub. And I was experimenting with animation and all sorts of different things. And James wanted to find a very strange kind of original visual artist to work on one of his graphic novels. And a lot of the people at Curious Pictures were super trendy hipsters, so they were a little snobby for Jim, and I love that he was commercial. I was like, I want to learn how is he, selling so many books and his mind. And I was just curious. So we did a graphic novel together. And then I kind of said, hey, by then I was doing a lot of music videos, and I pitched one of his stories into a buddy of mine, who was I don't want to say names because it became a disaster, but he was we did my first uncredited TV show with James Patterson was pure just ignorance, because I pitched a book that I kind of, in my research of who he was, I picked up a book that apparently was already sold and dead in the industry. Industry call it dead when people buy a project, they shoot a pilot and then it dies and then they shot it again, and it was like a dead project, like agents didn't know. But the way I pitched it really resonated with this guy, and he was at the right place at the right time. So we did a whole two seasons of like an incredible show, and he made a lot of money from that. And that kind of like, he said, hey, why don't you come and work with me? So I worked on a very strange arrangement, which was non-exclusive. So through all of the years that I worked with Patterson, I was still doing my art things and my own projects with my brother. It was just a great opportunity to dive in and build and learn from this, from him. And it was fantastic. I mean, I really enjoyed the work and like all the people I met. And we did a ton of TV shows and movies and, developed ideas for stuff. So it was great. But came to a time that I had my own TV shows, and just the time would not allow me to keep doing it. And we all saw it coming. I had to move on my own path. But I really am grateful for all that I learned from him. And so it was great.
It's a really cool story. So you're in the right place at the right time. Talk about a little bit about your imprint at Simon & Schuster, because that seems like a kind of a unique
Well, that's a great story as well. I mean, it wasn't that forced at all. It was a time I've always been able to look at stories and develop them and kind of find people that are great writers and help them, or painters or whatever. I like kind of love to, if I see something that I'm excited about, I don't have to be the writer or the creator. I can always also be a kind of a producer. So more than an imprint, I'm like, I have a book kind of system with a couple friends that we really look at stories and then see how we can develop them. So sometimes that means developing a book. And we were with Simon Schuster at the time. It was Judith Kerr. She then left to HarperCollins, but she was the running Atria at Simon Schuster, and with her, you know, I proposed her a really interesting plan of doing these curated stories that I found, some of them, you know, really out there books or memoirs. So some of the books that I've published, for example, are ideas that I meet that don't fit into my little imprint, that fit more into their own thing. For example, I did a book with a futurist, and it's not a fiction book. It's a memoir, kind of a self-help memoir of his own work as a futurist, mm-hmm. called Future You. And that one didn't really fit in Simon Schuster's kind of imprint. I wanted it more to be in the main publisher because it was more of a self-help / futurist manifesto than my own travels and fiction. So all of this opportunity really came from the need of like discovering writers that feel that they were overlooked and that I was passionate enough to put some time and energy in developing those stories.
Well, I mean, I could pick your brain all day about this really, really interesting winding career. Of course, I want to talk about your writing process and the writing life and Pinata, of course. If you could talk a little bit about kind of just the genesis of this story, because I understand, you know, it kind of sprang from a need for you to, you know, express some anger that had come up. And, you know, it seems that you've talked about this in the past, just kind of being able to channel some of your, you know, feelings about, you know, obviously, especially some of your personal experiences, but talk a little bit about kind of the genesis of Pinata and, you know, how this kind of came to be, and then talk a little bit about the process that went into making it.
It tails to the your first question of my hyphenate. I don't know how do you use that word?
I called you a multi-hyphenate because you're an award-winning author, you're a visual artist, you're a, you know, writer, producer. It's hard to kind of put everything into one. You know, you're someone who's really kind of undefinable, if that makes more sense.
I mean, yeah. In the funny way, I've been thinking a lot about this because it comes up now and then, and I love the question, and I do believe that it's definable, because what I do is my natural place is images. Like I'm very, images are my first kind of images through memory are my first kind of connector. And a lot of the work, even though it seems different, if I sit down with you and you grab any of the things that I've done, even the books that I didn't write, but I just helped publish, and you sit down and I go through the process and the story of how each one of them got made, they have a real connection in process. It's all like, you know, I have a memory that triggers. I always use, you know, oddly enough, my sense of scent, you know, but even things that I find, like, you know, one great example is I'm not a gambler. I don't like poker. And I'm not really that crazy of celebrity culture, even though I do have some good actors who are good friends of mine, but I'm not into that whole celebrity vibe. But I was having some drinks with a larger-than-life Mexican friend of mine, And we were in a fancy club because he was doing some catering there, and a bunch of very pretty women started to approach us. Now I'm very happy married, and my defense mechanism when somebody approached me is I just show pictures of my wife, my kids, and like I start talking with them because it was very they were trying to invite us to this like poker game, and that meeting became me developing a book with Molly Bloom, who published it, and then we took through one of my old lawyers, Ken Hertz, we took it to Aaron Sorkin, and once that we had Aaron Sorkin wanting to adapt it, then we took it to a bunch of financiers, starting with Mark Gordon, who really wanted to work again with Sorkin. So I really developed that project from soup to nuts, and it was what it triggered me was the memory I had of my mom when she was younger, and the fact that Molly was kind of very bossy, and her energy reminded me of my mom a little bit. And I was, I loved that she was a woman in a man's world, that she was kind of redefine herself through that angst, because she grew up with a bunch of brothers who were kind of overshining of her. And she was like, it just took her life into a really interesting twist, but it was not the poker or the celebrity or all of that stuff that interests me. And so the process of that, between that and a painting or a character in one of my own books, is very similar. It's a layer of memories that connect with me viscerally to a story or an idea or a person or a feeling. And then I become kind of like a dog with a bone that will not let it go. In fact, for a whole year, I was trying to convince her to leave the poker world and do a project with me. And she stopped talking to me for a few months. I can get a little intense when I see something. And then she came back after she got arrested by the FBI. So that was a really great sample of things that I was feeling. It wasn't, you know, I didn't see it, oh, I'm going to do a movie to make money. It was more oh my God, this is a great story about women in a man's world and how she can overcome that and outsmart them all, like in a chess, like almost like Molly's Game is a predator of like the Queen's Gambit, you know, in a way. And so it was a really amazing process to develop it. And I really don't see the difference between that and some of the ideas that I work in my contemporary art pieces and stuff. And again, like that pisses off a lot of people in the art world. And I've been told by people in the art world, you know, I just want to work with artists that are only artists. And I'm like, I don't know what that means, because even you know, all of the artists have tried different mediums. You know, Giacometti tried furniture design, and same with Francis Bacon. And, you know, any artists have tried different things. And there was this notion that you have to choose like one adventure and stick to it. And I love when people can do that. It's just my brain works differently. And I, you know, without trying, I end up like, you know, in the middle of a conversation like that, and then I want to make it work. And I, you know, I have dozens of projects like that in the middle of, you know, it might take me another year to convince someone that let's do a book together or a movie or a TV show or a painting even. But it's all very organic on reality of my circumstance, and it all starts from the same kind of core of my curiosity and my drive to come through it, of those interests to really manifest them, like to, you know, in terms of Piñata, I did a lot of research since I was a kid on the cultures in Mexico, because in Mexico City, by the way, when you grow up in that city, it's crazy that you go to the downtown Mexico City. My mom was friends with a lot of archaeologists and indigenous leaders. And like you go into the Zócalo, the main plaza, and there's Aztec faces breaking from the pavement as if they're trying to escape the underworld. And you grow up seeing that. And then as a kid, very early on, they take you to Templo Mayor, which is this pyramid underneath the churches in Mexico, an excavation where you can literally go underneath the street and visit a pyramid that is kind of at the foundation of some of the oldest churches from the time of the Spaniard conquest, which they used the same stones to pull, they pulled them from the pyramids because the Spaniard during the conquest, they were smart. They said, like, on top of every pyramid, let's build a church because that's the centers where people go to pray. So let's just give them a continuation. So it was a very strategic reason. But it was very traumatic for me to see it. And then, you know, that's on the one hand. And then years later, I discovered in a family tree, there was illustrations of all my ancestors from my father's side of the family. And I discovered that I had that direct ancestor who was a Zapotec. And it was just amazing because my family, because they are French immigrants, I grew up with some of them being pretentious of trying to hide their indigenous connection. And I could be prouder for that. So when I discovered this years and years ago, you know, I was very excited. I haven't done my DNA because I think that's I don't care. You know, like I feel it in my heart and I don't want to know the truth. Like if the whole thing they showed me with the family tree, it's an old document, but if for any reason it's not true, like, I don't want to know. I have a tremendous love and respect for those cultures, and I want to claim a little part of it, you know, in however I want to get it. And I also think that those DNA are businesses to gather information, so I'm very suspicious with them. But to me, that was the first element of the journey. And then I always have these shoe drop moments when my books or my paintings or something important starts, and in the terms of piñata, you know, it triggered when, I won't say the name, but the last president of the United States, who was this horrible human being, he said something weird, and I remember waking up from screams from my daughter because she's very young but very politically active, and I could hear her rage screaming at the TV of some dumb thing he said, and I remember feeling that rage. And In Ghost Ray, my first horror novel, I was very focused on two male protagonists. And in this one, because I was raising a young pre-teenager who was just becoming a teenager, I felt, you know, it triggered me to write Piñata. The other trigger was through my daughter's scream was like the trigger to start writing. But before that trigger, there was a painting I discovered that I thought, oh my God, how come no one has done anything with this? This is crazy. I saw in my multiple, I call them my wormholes of research. I have multiple avenues of things that I dive and I spend years like just things that interest me. And in this one was about certain, you know, things about colonialism. And I saw this painting of you know, you grow up with this beautiful song called Dale, 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 which is about, I'm not going to sing it, I have the worst voice in history, but the song, you know, it's about breaking the piñatas when you go to every birthday. And the song is pretty dark if you really look into it, because it's like, don't, dale, 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 no, hit it, hit it, hit it. Don't lose your way, because if you lose your way, you lose the, you know, you can lose your destiny. It like goes on, and it's darker than it sounds. And people sing it in a very nice way about like the don't lose the road, but it can be about your soul, you know. And then this painting I discovered was illustrating that the Catholic Church, to indoctrinate some young children, they would paint piñatas with the symbols of their gods and then force these kids to break the piñata and eat the food. They were starving, so they would break the piñata and then eat the fallen food. Meanwhile, at the same time, the Catholic Church, you know, it's a cannibalistic society, because, you know, and my father's family is very Catholic, but they, you know, I have both the Jewish and the Catholic, so I'm screwed. And they eat the flesh of the gods and drink the blood of God. And it's pretty brutal when you're a kid and they take you and then you see that that they're eating the flesh of God. Like, I remember being 5 and being told that, and I was like, why would I want to do that? That seems horrible. The guy is nailed and he's bloody, and I want to eat that flesh. Screw this. And so I was very mortally like scared of the whole enterprise, and just the idea to see that they were, grabbing children to forcing them to hit piñatas. Meanwhile, everybody used it for the party, so it's kind of like blew in my head. And then that, in combination with my daughter's scream, I really like couldn't stop writing this and coming up with arcs, and being Mexican. But my children were born in America, so they're Americans. And also that kind of like things that you win and things that you lose. I touched upon it in Ghost Radio, but I really, that really evolved into Piñata. And I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying it's like, like all great horror genre, you're talking about big things and big themes. And you're using the genre to kind of help you digest it and talk about it, and that's those things happen in Piñata hopefully in a effective and beautiful way. Like, I talk about the memory of how now it sounds and what happens when we forget it, and the Nahuatl language, which is just from the cultures of Central Mexico, but happened to be the Aztecs, but there's all sorts of other cultures that spoke Nahuatl, and they were, it's a language that is still alive, but it's, you always fear that, what will happen to those gods when we all forget the language and how it sounds. So that idea kind of is peppered into the novel.
Definitely some much deeper themes running under the surface there. And of course, I will link to your home base there, leopoldogu.net, and the book. And yeah, I just wanted to say, and congrats on the work. It is really, really compelling, and it just kind of sucks you in to its own wormhole, as you put it. But yeah, it's just been described as a bone-chilling possession tale, perfect for fans of Hereditary and A Head Full of Ghosts. Based on the true horrific story of the Spanish conquistadors that used piñatas to force Aztec children to destroy their gods. I definitely get that sense that you are wrestling with some much bigger themes throughout your work, of course. But tell me, kind of like what's next for you? I know that, I wanted to ask kind of how you juggle these projects, or how you decide to, we've spoken with a lot of authors who do the same kind of thing, which you like to call like productive procrastination, where you're kind of working on one project while another one is kind of simmering on the back burner, and it kind of probably gives you that creative juice to kind of jump from one project to the other. But yeah, what are you working on now? And what do you have, aside from promoting the latest, what have you got cooking?
Yeah, I mean, like, there's a lot of things that because of COVID, a few of my projects kind of got collided into the same time. So I just published another book called Monarca, which is the opposite of Piñata, because it's an illustrated fable that I co-wrote with my friend Eva Arigis, and it's about the butterflies that go from Canada to Michoacán. So it's all painted by me. I did over, hundreds of drawings and paintings about these butterflies. And I wrote it for kind of like all family. It's a really different type of book, and it just came out. So it's crazy that they're coming out almost at the same time, except for a couple months time. And then Piñata, obviously it's my baby. I just, it's coming out now. And I'm already writing a sequel that, I promised my beautiful publishers of Tor, Nightfire. They are the best, one of the best publishers I've ever worked with. And they've been really fun to collaborate and to help me, to keep me focused and true I love those people, and we're editing both shows. One of them I co-created with my brother. We adapted a graphic novel by Mark Miller called American Jesus, and we shot it in Mexico. And it's a beautiful show that will come later this year, called The Chosen, El Elegido. And then which is a great international cast. And we have Tenoch Huerta, who's the Namor in the Black Panther, and Diana Agron, who was in Glee, and she's in a few really great movies recently, and very talented non-actors that we found all over Mexico, literally. And it's in Spanish and English, and it has, you know, it's a really great, ambitious project that I like to boast about it, that it's a little bit like, remember that movie Stand By Me?
Yeah.
So it's kind of Stand By Me, but with a Mexican supernatural twist. That's kind of the tone that we wanted to go for.
Yeah.
And then I have another show that one I didn't write. I just produced, but I developed from scratch. There's an author who won the Man Booker Prize and the National Book Award called Marlon James. He's Jamaican, and I developed a TV show with him and Channel 4 and now HBO called Get Millie Black. And it also comes out this year at some point, or early next year, probably this year. And Get Millie Black is going to be on HBO, and it's a Jamaican noir kind of detective story, and I'm super excited. And Marlon is a fantastic, you know, world class author that I convinced him to do TV, and he would say it, that he wrote this show a little bit so that I didn't bother him so much. He wrote a book called A Brief History of Seven Killings that is pretty famous book, and so I'm very excited about that show, because it's a literary noir story, you know, with a lot of guts. And then we're doing all sorts of other, you know, films and documentaries, but art is my, you know, one of my biggest passions. So I have a thriving art studio in New York City, where I'm making beautiful, crazy contemporary art and paintings, sculptures, photos, like all sorts of things of expression and creativity, and all of the things that I make kind of echo into the paintings and to the sculptures. So it's definitely a full plate. But you know, when you love these things, and you know, I'm a dad. That's my biggest project, is my kids, my family. But when you are when you love as much as I do love what I do, it's not work. It's really like, I just, like my son, who's I have a daughter and a son, and he asked me one day if we were successful, and I said, listen, as long as they let me do this crazy stuff, we could be more successful. I don't want more. I just want to continue what I have, that I've been able to make books and films and art for all these years. So I just want to continue doing that. And it's a privilege. And I'm, you know, so grateful for everyone that has helped me along the way. So that's, I'm truly great. I'm grateful for you. I'm grateful for the time. I'm grateful for the publishers, for studios that, you know, it's like winning the lottery over and over again.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, we are grateful for you, your words, your wisdom, your work. And of course, I'll point at your Instagram too there, which has quite a bit of your original artwork displayed there. And it is really, really beautiful stuff. Yeah. So I guess I got one fun one for you before we kind of wrap up with your advice to other writers. Yeah. If you could have an all expense paid dinner to your favorite spot in the world with any author from any era, who would you take? And where would you take them?
Oh, excellent question. I would probably do a dinner in Oaxaca with a young chef called Hugo Duran, who's a genius, who uses indigenous foods, and he's really traveled every inch in Mexico to find, like, and he uses fire, which is my type of food. In Oaxaca, is my favorite food. And I would somewhere in the ocean where it's crispy and you're outside with a big fire, and and he's cooking in multiple cities. I also love to cook, so I would probably join him and help him. And the writers I would invite for sure would be Mikhail Bulgakov, the Russian. He's dead. He's just The Master and Margarita is one of my favorite, you know, books of all time. And I read his letters and he's great. Then there's a 15th century nun that I'm in love with. And my daughter's name is, you know, based on her. It's Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz. She's a poet and a mathematician, an inventor, a lover for both for men and women. She's an extraordinary woman. And anybody that listens to this, apart from reading Piñata, they should buy her book. She wrote many, many books on poetry and stuff, but there's a book about her by Octavio Paz that won him the Nobel called The Tricks of Faith, and it's Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz. And she's kind of like, you know, the intellectual side of Frida Kahlo, if you can imagine, you know, the first feminist of the whole entire continent, I think, and one of the most interesting women of all time. And I fell in love with her through that book. My wife knows how much I loved her. So I asked, like, she carried the baby. So she had the right to name them, obviously. But I said, I suggested Inés and she liked the name with an S and an accent on the E. And so that's where it come from. So I would have it, Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz for sure. Mikhail, how many you want me in the dinner?
Because I however go, many like.
I would have her for sure. I would excellent. Love, and I would love, you know, always is interesting, you know, Dylan Thomas. I would love to have him there. And there's a million of them that I would have. Dinners are very specific and, you know, you have to be, they have to be fun. Like I was very lucky to meet very big famous writers. I'm not going to name their names here because they're famous and people love them. But I met a couple who were just awful people. So I don't want them to be in my
at your party.
You know, one of them is amazing. I love his books to death. He passed away, but you know, he was miserable all the time. So that's my only concern. But I know that Sor Juana was fun because of her writing, her poetry, and sexy and crazy and challenging. I know that Mikhail Bulgakov was amazing and fun and a total madman. And I also would love Mark Twain. Like, who wouldn't okay. want Mark Twain?
And Mark Twain. We'll throw in Mark Twain.
Yeah, probably. Probably that would be a fun dinner.
Love it. Well, fantastic. So, you know, if you could just leave your fellow scribes with just one final note on just how to keep going, you know, through the good times or the bad. You know, we've all kind of been through it, through these concentric circles of crises, and we continue to persevere, obviously. But yeah, it seems like the world's spinning a little faster these days. How to keep going?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I love to answer it because the reality is we all came out of like an apocalypse, two apocalypses, one presidential and one health-wise. And I think that there's a lot of negativity that we have to try to avoid or minimize. Insecurities, you know, of and ignorance. And what the opposite of that, it's all ignorant. Like all of the, everything they say is based on ignorance, from their take on the weather to the take on politics to the take on immigration. It's almost amazing how you kind of want to get them to understand something, but it's just unbelievable ignorance. And I do believe that the world is better when you're curious. And I always feel like, don't let the algorithms of social media define you. Like if you guys look at my algorithms, that I push them to be positive. Like I just block any negativity. If I want to read politics, I go to really well-written, established, you know, writers and philosophers and compare them. Like I don't go into like left or right newspapers completely. I try to go deeper than that, and I take it for, you know, I'm not a politician, so I don't, you know, you want to hear what people actually say within context. But I feel like it's very important to fight the algorithms of social media and not let the negativity of that drive us, because it's proven. That's why I think that, you know, Elon Musk's a fool and fake when he talks about the freedom of speech, because there's no freedom of speech in those algorithms. These are machines that are addicted to money, and to that's how they were programmed. So the Twitters and the Instagrams and all of those things are addicted to the basic common denominator. And it's been proven by many scientists that it tends to go darker because you get more reaction, you get more passionate clicks when somebody says some stupid thing on QAnon than if a panda just was born. So you get much more passion and energy, whether it's negative or whatever, from negativity. So negativity breeds negativity, and it's destroying youth. And I'm so lucky that my kids barely touch it and try to avoid it at all costs. But I think that to other writers, is the first step is try to find your spots of happy that makes you happy. Curiosity is the fix of everything. If you're in a writer's block, I've given many classes to even to Columbia University about how to break the chains of blocks or dry spells. And you know, I always tell people I'm a visual guy, so I found my own system to fight creative blocks. And what I do is a technique that works for me, but it might not work for everyone. So everybody has to find their own kind of trigger. And to me, my technique is my research, but also I do a meditation kind of trip when I'm doing big paintings, and I'm doing sometimes in my marks, you'll see repetition of lines and dots and weird things. Those are kind of my grid of going and getting into the zone. And there are visual concerns that produce a kind of a zone state, if you can call it. Some people meditate, some people go into the gym, some people run, some people dance, some people get, you know, crazy drugs, and like everybody has their own system to get there to the zone. My way is I start to repeat these visual concerns, almost like Jack Nicholson in The Shining, writing the same word over and over again. And I get into, because I'm dyslexic and I have a lot of, you know, little tics and weird things that I have to trick my mind to it. And then what I do is I have a very acute sense of memory and scent. Like even I dream with scents, and sometimes I wake up dreaming of my grandfather and his scent is still in the room. So obviously my brain produces such a clarity on the scent memory that I can remember it. And then everything starts to smell like him, almost like a switch. And I use that. And the way I've used it is like, for example, I go into my meditative state and I start to remember very small details. So always start small. So like what interests you, or to me, like, for example, is the doorknob of my grandmother's, from my father's side, door when we would visit her on Sundays. And it was black and rusty. And they had little holes where we would love, when I was five probably, I would love to go into those holes to see who would come, because she had a big patio, and I would see who was going to open the door. And then once you go into the zone and really remember that moment, then you remember a step into the house, and then what's right, what's to the left. And by now, after, you know, if you do it consistently, suddenly you have a vivid memory of things that were totally lost through memory, and your memory is like a muscle, and it's like having your own little movie, your home movie of your grandmother that you never painted, that you never captured. And I use that at the same time that I'm doing research, at the same time that I'm collecting images and stuff. But that's my process. And then I put it up in the wall, like I write about the memories, or I paste photographs of the internet that I get, or museums that I go and see, or parks, or even random people. Like, yes, like I was in a restaurant I walk my dog and they let you in this place, and I was having a sandwich, and this chef, they have an open kitchen, and this Asian chef, she had this incredible shape of head. So I sneaked a picture without her realizing, and that's going on the wall because I love the curvature of her cranium, and it's going to appear in my paintings, or maybe in a book I'll end up describing her as part of a character. And so I do those processes over and over again, and then I never run out of. And so, but the most important part of this advice to your listeners, to other writers, is that you do all of this research, but then you always have to find every week or every 2 weeks, entire days where you do nothing. When you learn to go into what I call the anti-zone, then you go into space and you literally for hours, you decompress and look at nothing and don't engage. Like try to look at a flower or the ocean and disconnect with no thoughts. And as thoughts are coming into about your family and whatever, try to empty yourself. And I do it every week myself, but everybody should do a different. Some people need it every day, you know, like, I don't know. Some people need it once a month. Like I try every once a week to have at least half a day or a full day of nothing, of literally not being productive. And then the third advice is to fear the failures. Writer's block is through the fear of failing. It's the constant and you never beat the fear of failing completely ever. It's always there, but you have to work with it and play with it and push it, and can't let that fear become your total master. You know, so those are my three ways of my very basic advice. I've given this lecture a few times professionally, and I mm-hmm. it's about a couple of hours. So I'm giving you the
Cliff Notes.
The Cliff Notes of my 2 hours of how to be creative.
Beautiful. Well, we could pick your brain all day about creativity, of course, and we'll have to have you back at some point to do that. But again, Leopoldo, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. Best of luck with the tour and with all of your projects that you've got going. Really excited to see some of these shows that you got cooking and are producing, and of course, more prose when it comes out. But yeah, congratulations on the work, and we look forward to chatting with you in the future.
Thank you. And thank you on behalf of every writer, because we need more. You're a writer, and we need to help each other more. So thank you so much for your time. I really love this time that we talked, and I'm here for you next, whenever you want me back. I'm happy to do more of these things. I love talking about creativity and books and things that I love.
Yeah, it really shines through, and we appreciate your wisdom and your passion, honestly, really comes through in everything. And Pinata is sure to be devoured and loved. It is a little spooky, I'm not going to lie to you, but I'm a big fan of horror, honestly. And you've been compared to some really, really talented horror writers. So congrats, you've earned it.
Thank you so much. A big hug to your audience as well.
Thanks so much for joining us for this file. And if you're a fan of the show, simply head over to writerfiles.fm for more. That's writerfiles.fm.